The green economy is the future economy and is Northeast Ohio's opportunity to keep jobs and bring in important jobs, but deliberate action must be taken. That's according to a new report by the Fund for Our Economic Future called The Practical Guide to a Green Economy. It states what the region has going for it is it's a manufacturing hub. Simply, it makes things, and it sits by a big body of fresh water. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. This hour, we'll learn more about the Green Guide from the president of the Fund for Our Economic Future, Bethia Burke, and we'll hear what specifically the region must do to position itself for a transition to the green economy. Later, a look at the Oberlin Review, a student-run newspaper which serves as the paper of record celebrating its 150th year. Finally, a conversation with Cleveland poet George Bilguer. First, the news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Good morning, and thanks so much for joining us. In 2022, the Biden-Harris administration passed the Inflation Reduction Act, a bill that addressed healthcare costs, tax rates, and climate concerns. The bill included $370 billion in spending and tax credits in low-emission forms of energy to fight climate change. And in these past 2 years, we've seen how the IRA is impacting the intersection of economics and the environment. And here on The Sound of Ideas, just last week, we discussed growing interest in solar energy and electric vehicle manufacturing in this state, with each of those items affecting pocketbooks and factories and farms across Ohio. Now, a new report from the Fund for Our Economic Future is drilling further into the intersection of economic growth and the environment. It's called The Practical Guide to the Green Economy, and it's designed to serve as a kind of roadmap for businesses as well as civic and community leaders as the region aims to be more intentional when thinking about economic growth. So to begin our show today, we'll talk about the Green Economy Guide. Later on this hour, we'll mark the 150th anniversary of the Oberlin Review, Oberlin College's student-run newspaper, and we'll hear from Northeast Ohio poet George Bilguer. But first, with me to discuss the guide to the green economy is the president of the Fund for Our Economic Future, Bethia Burke. Bethia, so glad to have you in studio.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. If you'd like to join in the conversation or you have a question for Bethia, please call 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Okay, Bethia, first let's talk about what is meant by the green economy. I'm sure people have an idea in their head, maybe renewable energies and things like that. But how does the fund define green economy?
Yeah, so for this work, we just took a really broad and expansive view. So it is actually quite controversial to define the green economy, and yet we must have a baseline in order to understand what to do in response to the greening of the economy. And so what we said in this guide was it's really anything that has to do with greener products. So you can think about electric cars as a green product. Anything that has to do with greener processes. So an electric car can be built with products that are not intentionally, processes that are not intentionally greener, or you could also, those processes that go into it, so how the steel is made for a manufactured product, so greener processes. And then changed consumer behavior. So thinking about how a person is incentivized or not to buy that greener product, that electric vehicle. So all of those things we said count in this realm of the green economy so that we can think about the ways in which those changes really change how we think about the work of economic development in the region.
And you said it's controversial to define green economy. Can you tell me a little bit about why?
I think it really fundamentally is there are different disciplines that come into this work, and their idea of what might count is different. So a climate activist is going to think about it potentially differently than a government official, than a resident, than an economic developer, because their goals might be different. So somebody who is driving for zero carbon emissions has a different agenda than somebody who is driving for inclusive economic growth. And that changes what's in somebody's mind about what should count as the green economy. And yet we're actively transitioning as a region, as a nation. And so putting a stake in the ground so that we can start figuring out what to do felt important.
Yeah, definitely. So early in the report, to cite the investment dollars that states are already seeing through a clean economy tracker, Ohio ranks 10th in total investments and 11th in total jobs attracted. That seems pretty good. So what's happening in our state and region already from your vantage point? And are we seeing green economy jobs and practices currently?
Yeah, I think where we're starting is that we're starting from a fundamentally good position. And this has been elevated. So you look outside, you see a Great Lake. Water resources are important. They're important to companies. They're important to people. We also know that we have a relatively temperate climate. That's a good thing. And then the third thing, relatively sort of negative weather events, extreme weather events. And then the third thing is when we think about where we are today and where investments are being made, they're being made in particular in manufacturing. And so we're a high concentration of manufacturing in the region. That's important because that's where a lot of the investment dollars are going. That's the baseline. So we're starting from a place that has positive comparative advantage to potentially other places across the United States.
When you look at, so just last week, we did a week of environmental topics in celebration of Earth Day, and we had a day allocated to solar, and there's lots of work being done in creating solar farms in Ohio. And then we had a conversation purely about the manufacturing of EVs, electric vehicles, and their parts. And I was surprised to learn at everything that's going on. So do you think Ohio, out of necessity in trying to place itself and have a growing economy for the future, is already happening?
Yeah, so I think those things that I cited, the sort of relatively resilient weather, the water, the starting point of a manufacturing economy, those aren't new changes, right? That is a good starting point for the region. It's also not unique. So it's not, we are not the only place that has access to fresh water and has a strong manufacturing base, right? That's can describe other places as well. And so I think that what we are trying to elevate with this practical guide is we're starting from a competitive position. And if we want to build and grow and capture the future, we have to think about how we're organizing to make smart investments to elevate, grow, and continue that. And that is that's different than observing the current state. It's about proactively driving towards a future state.
Okay, so one of the facets of the report is the idea and recommendation that the region, Northeast Ohio, can be a green jobs hub where businesses and industries can form a symbiotic relationship with each other. So what industries and sectors do you have in mind? Can you envision how they might work together?
Yeah, what I might elevate there is the importance of place as it relates to how we think about incentivizing inclusive economic growth. So we at the Fund for Economic Future for a long time have highlighted how important it is that we think differently about where we grow jobs. Mm-hmm. It matters not just that there is a job, but where that job is, that somebody can access that job. That fundamentally has the concentrations of jobs, having jobs in one place so that transportation can access them, that people can take alternatives to from cars to work, for example. All of those things matter fundamentally, regardless of whether the economy is greening.
Sure.
When we talk about greening job hubs, it's about how those investments might be different to attract the kind of industry that you just described. So that is about thinking about last week, that the Site Readiness for Good Jobs Fund announced that they purchased 7000 Central, the Christie Lights building. Hmm. It's a vacant property. It used to house industry. It does not anymore. It has been vacant for decades. It's a place that's really important to think about how it redevelops into something else.
Sure.
When we think about that investment, 10, even 5 years ago, there would not have been the funding to think about investments that also think about it connecting to a greener future. So thinking about if that property that is currently not an estate that can be inhabited is redeveloped, is it redeveloped with the ability to have solar on its roof? That changes how you design the roof. Is it redeveloped in a way to have to have green walls. That's different than if you're not going to invest in that. Is it redeveloped in a way that has access to bike paths? When we recently did the Opportunity Corridor redevelopment, even getting a bike path next to the road, and that was not that long ago, was a really hard discussion to have because it wasn't part of the baseline infrastructure.
Right.
So all that to say that when we talk about greening job hubs, we're talking about two things. It's what investments are prioritized in place when you do that redevelopment, especially in places that have not had industry growth in a long time, so they take a lot of investment to get there. How do you get that level of investment that makes it competitive 5 years from now?
Sure.
And we think we have to think about what industry will demand in the future, and then what kinds of industry are you trying to attract? So cleaner industry.
So is this thinking about where a company might be in 10 years from now? Is that part of the future proofing that you talk about in your report?
Yeah, so it's about how do we think about places that don't have jobs today, this 7000 Central, this place that doesn't have any current user, that has to be made competitive, and you're trying to predict
sure.
what a company will want in 5 years. We can already see, that companies are asking about what kind of energy can they source if they were to come into the region. So
interesting.
Those individuals who work on the front line of responding to requests from businesses asking about places they could find a site in the region, increasingly they're seeing questions about what kind of energy mix might I have access to? Because those businesses have set proactive goals around decarbonization.
Sure.
So that's one of the things, like, we have to think about how we can develop in a way that we're moving towards this evolving future that we're not quite in yet, but we can
sure.
see coming.
Right.
And then we can talk a little bit more about future proof businesses. But that's
yeah.
the place aspect of it.
Okay, well, tell me about future-proofing businesses.
When we think about future-proofing businesses, we have both what I just mentioned, which is companies that are trying to come to the region. That often gets a lot of headlines. You want to cut a ribbon. You want to see Intel coming into the region. You can cut a ribbon. You can see a plant go up. You can see new jobs from a new company. That's
sure.
very exciting and important. Most of the job growth that happens in Northeast Ohio and anywhere comes from existing businesses expanding. Our companies here are often the supply chain that goes into an electric vehicle, right? The development of the battery that goes into the electric vehicle, for example. Those companies need to be competitive for whoever is buying their product. If that bigger company that's buying the product mm-hmm. is changing its goals, and that larger company has a goal to reduce the carbon emissions from its supply chain, that eventually hits the businesses here.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things we're talking about in this work is how that support can come to help those companies that are in the supply chain grow towards the future that is already underway but is coming in the next 5 years,
right.
where they will have to be adapted to these new goals of the companies that they're supplying to.
Yeah.
I would say that it might seem like that's something that companies should just do on their own, but I might give an example.
Okay.
So my husband for a long time worked in commercial HVAC. And one of the things 10 years ago he tried very hard to do was to get he could see if you buy a piece of equipment, if you buy a furnace that is more efficient, that costs you less to run, it is better for the environment, it burns less fuel, and it's better for your operating costs. It's going to cost you less year
sure.
over year. And there were even tax credits for that capital investment. So you could pay back the initial investment with the savings over time, and he could pencil it out. The person making the decision about that upfront capital investment was different than the person whose job it was to reduce operating expenses
sure.
day over day, year over year in that company. And it's whoever's priority is most important that gets to make that decision. And 99% of the time, to his great frustration,
yeah.
it was the person who had to find the money for the upfront capital expense that wouldn't or couldn't do it. We have to be able to shift to a future, because a lot of this change, like changing out your furnace, changing out your heat pump. You can think of that. That's initial expenses that aren't built into the same line item and are hard to do. We have to make sure we're supporting the access to the resources that allows companies to change for the future that we can see coming, so they're not, you know, caught on their heels 5 years from now when they're no longer able to meet the demands of their of the companies they're supplying to.
So it's intentional thinking about the future with the assumption that people want and companies want to be environmentally friendly.
Well, it's, I would just say it's more
we
than
have like a minute left, Bethia.
Oh, so, more than an assumption because okay. they're public-facing goals. So companies have changed what they're saying that they're driving towards, and they are holding themselves accountable.
So assumption was the wrong word. It's a known fact. Yep. All right, Bethia Burke, I'm so sorry that we've run out of time. President of the Fund for Our Economic Future, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, coming up next, we're going to have a quick break, but when we return, two editors of the Oberlin Review, the student-led newspaper, which is celebrating its 150th anniversary. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. This month, the Oberlin Review, the student-led newspaper out of Oberlin College and Conservatory, celebrates its 150th anniversary. The paper marked the anniversary with a journalism career panel, as well as a special edition of the paper featuring special articles from the past century and a half. That anniversary comes 6 years after the Oberlin News Tribune closed, leaving the Review as the only paper covering the community. It also comes at a time when students want their voices heard more, and a long-lasting student-run paper like The Review offers that unique opportunity. I now want to welcome the two student co-editors-in-chief of the Oberlin Review to discuss the anniversary. Delaney Fox and Nikki Keating, welcome to both of you.
Hi.
Great. Are you guys together or in separate areas?
We're together.
I love it. Okay. If any of our listeners would like to join the conversation about the 150th anniversary of the Oberlin Review, call 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. So, Delaney and Nikki, you two are both in the class of 2025, and interestingly enough, you're not journalism or communications majors. So, briefly tell us about what you're studying and how you both got into the paper. Delaney, we'll start with you.
Yeah, so I am a double degree student actually at Oberlin. Oberlin offers a double degree, a bachelor's of music in vocal, I'm studying vocal performance in the conservatory, and then I'm getting a bachelor's of arts in English at the college. And I am really passionate about my English degree and about writing and editing. So I actually got into the Review through the production editor position, which is kind of just a copy editing job. And I started the fall of my sophomore year. And then I worked my way up, kind of. I got an editor position doing the conservatory section, obviously because of my connections in the conservatory. And then I applied to be the editor-in-chief, and that was the story.
And Nikki?
Yeah, I am a double major, Africana Studies and Psychology, and with a minor in Sociology. So I was really passionate about just overall news about the world we live in. And so I originally got into the Review as a news editor before I was a senior staff writer for news. So I wrote a lot of articles about just news on campus and in the community. And then I kind of moved my way up to just an official news editor, which means I kind of got to look at all the stories as well as continue writing. And then I applied to be managing editor, which was kind of working on like the budget of the Review, and then I just hop on over to editor-in-chief.
So the Review is the paper of record in the region. What kind of staff are you working with? Is it a big number, a small number of people? Do they contribute from time to time, or is there any full-time reporters?
Yeah, we have a staff of 35. Wow. So we have a big staff, but we only really have 12 section editors, and they are tasked with finding the stories of the week. Most of them write the week, so they're assigned their own stories, but they also are tasked with assigning students who are interested in writing or getting involved with the review stories. So we start on Sunday with pitch, of course, where we talk about the stories we're going to run this week with the intention of publishing on Friday. And then we spend the week pretty much getting those stories together, editing. We have a production editor team, about 12 students as well, and their task is copy editing, and that means just looking for APA style and grammar. And then we put it into a layout. So we have 4 layout editors, and they are tasked with putting the newspaper in an InDesign format that we can not only print, but also use to publish stories online. And so we finished up around Friday afternoon, pretty much. So it's a full week thing. The only real like kind of break is Saturday, but it's fun.
We got an email from Peter, who wrote, "My father worked for the Oberlin Review as a student in the 50s. One of my father's editorials was considered so radical, it was read into the congressional record by conservative McCarthy-era Republicans. My father was a chemistry major, not an English or politics major, as one might have assumed. He worked incredible hours to get the paper out while keeping up his coursework." So it does seem like there is a legacy of students who really put heart and soul into publishing the Oberlin Review. Do you both feel like you're a part of that longstanding tradition?
Yeah, totally. I think one of the things we did for this 150th celebration was work in special collections, making the special edition of our newspaper. And it was a publication of just reprints from our archives. And it was, I mean, so fascinating to see all of the things that people have written. And actually for our event, we had some articles published by a student here at the time in the 70s who actually came back for the event that we held in April. And it was just cool to meet alumni and have read their writing. And we really did feel like we had a family there. It was really cool.
Yeah. And that event you're talking about and the names associated with the school are very impressive. So there was this special forum held at the college that featured some Oberlin alumni and folks who had worked at the Review. So tell me, what was that like to hear from people like Peter Baker from the New York Times or Emily Nussbaum, who's won a Pulitzer Prize?
It was amazing, not only because we got to chat about, you know, working for the Review and what that meant as a student at Oberlin, but also for our staff, it was really interesting to hear about journalism today. Not only just interested in like how journalism works in this world, especially now with the digital age, sure, but also what it means for us to go into the field of journalism after we graduate, if that's what we want. And I think, you know, hearing from Peter Baker and Sonia Shaw and Emily Nussbaum is that they are three very different journalists. They have different areas, they have different even publications that they submit to. Sonia Shaw really is into writing books. And so it was really interesting to see kind of how their paths diverged from each other. But they all had, you know, that journalistic curiosity. Emily Nussbaum didn't necessarily work for the Oberlin Review. But, you know, during the conference, she was very much like, yeah, we were like, oh. But she was very kind in saying that, you know, formulated kind of how she thought about journalism and helped her kind of have that curiosity later in life. So it was also nice to hear that for our students who might not necessarily, you know, be too into journalism right now, but we'll get into it later.
Sure. So it kind of was the area that fostered that curiosity about the world around you. I'm curious. So let's talk about how the Review operates. And what is the paper's relationship to the faculty and administration at Oberlin College? Is there a sense of independence? Is there difficulty if you have to do a story that might be critical of the administration, or do you stay away from that? And I'll have you both answer that. Delaney?
Yeah, I would say we have a really great relationship with the administration currently. I'm only speaking from Nikki and I's time here for the past year as editors. But, you know, they're really responsive to our inquiries about certain stories. If we need if we have questions about certain things, they're really responsive and help us work through stuff. We get legal advice from the college when necessary. And in terms of faculty, we're really, really an independent student newspaper. I mean, our whole staff is students. We have a faculty advisor, Jan Cooper, who is one of the professors of writing and communication at Oberlin. And she is really wonderful whenever we need her. But we're really, really an independent newspaper, and we you know, call the shots for all of the stuff that we publish. So yeah, we're really thankful that the administration kind of lets us have that independence, and also that our faculty advisor lets us have that independence, because it's really meaningful for our education and to kind of do hands-on work here.
And Nikki, I'll have you add to that. I mean, the Oberlin Review's independence from the administration, and maybe your dynamic with the administration as well.
Yeah, I would say, you know, again, we are an independent newspaper, which means, you know, while we can confirm sources, we can ask questions with the administration, we are not bounded to them or have any obligations to them when it comes to our content. And so our job here is to help serve and protect our community as students and our community in the Oberlin larger community. And with that, that means publishing stuff regardless of our relationship with the administration. And I think that the administration have really respected that. I think also in these last couple of years, we've gotten a lot of administrative staff who have been journalists in the past. And so I think that they have kind of an idea and a respect for our journalistic neutrality, and also they understand kind of our ethical duty to the campus and town. And so I would say, again, like they let us function as an independent newspaper, but they are always, you know, open to questions and interviews and quotes.
Let's go ahead and take a call from Scott in Oberlin, who wants to say something about the Oberlin Review. Scott, good morning.
Howdy, folks. And I just wanted to say, it's like I'm a 27-year reader of the Oberlin Review. And I got to say, over the last few years, the last couple of years, especially coming out of COVID, which was devastating to the student population, and for continuity and whatnot at the newspaper and, of course, the college, you guys really got your A game on now. I mean, it's like the paper's really, it's like it's getting a lot better. You're broadening your coverage and everything, and especially the coverage of goings-on at City Hall and council meetings. I mean, we don't have that anymore, and so it's good to see. So keep up the good work. So,
thanks, Scott. Yeah, and I'll add to that, you know, what Scott's talking about, the Oberlin News Tribune served as the community paper, closed back in 2018. So truly, your paper is the paper of record for the city. So Delaney, does that affect how you view the role of the paper and what you choose to cover?
Yes, definitely. It's really important that we cover city ongoings. Something that we've implemented this year is the city council updates, and kind of like reviewing those weekly meetings and having some of our content kind of go to that. And make sure that we cover just city ongoings in general. And another thing that means is our responsibility just to get the newspaper out to community members.
Sure.
So we've been thinking a lot about distribution this year and how we can make sure that townspeople have access to the newspaper. Obviously, we distribute to our dorms and kind of like college buildings and facilities, but we also want to make sure that we can get to, you know, like the Kendall Retirement Home or, you know, Slow Train or some of these other kind of businesses in the town, so that community members can have access to the paper.
Nikki, I'm curious, what are your plans after Oberlin and kind of this thorough job as an editor of the school paper? But obviously you have other interests. I'd love to know next steps for you.
Yeah, of course. So both of us do have one more year to graduate. So fingers crossed on that.
Right.
But I, you know, it's something we think about, you know, even as juniors. I would love to pursue higher education. I'm very passionate. I would love to get my master's in Africana studies to eventually teach in some form. But I would always want to continue writing. I love journalism. I would love to continue to write for different publications. I'm originally from Washington, D.C. And so I read all of my little newspapers in D.C. That I could maybe contribute to in the future. And so I would love to continue journalism in that way. but probably also continue with furthering my education with the hopes of either getting a PhD in psychology or a master's in Africana studies.
Well, the academic world will be lucky to have you. And Delaney, I'm curious, what are your future plans as of now?
Yeah, so I'm really interested in using my English degree. I love editing, and one of the reasons why I love this job is just to interact with so many writers and so many writers writing and really kind of learn the nuance of their voice and all of this stuff. I love editing. We use AP Style here, which is like the American Journalism Style Guide, and I've become intimately familiar with it. So I'm really interested in careers that, you know, focus on communication and editing and you know, maybe publishing. All of those are kind of options for me. And I think the review, one thing that we kind of realized from the career panel is that, you know, journalism is perhaps a declining field. All three of our panelists said that it was, you know, journalism is different than it was 30 years ago, and it's harder to get a job in journalism. And something that I was committed, something I realized was that, you know, the review prepares you for careers outside of journalism. It prepares you for, it gives you skills for leadership, just good communication, how to write a good email. Sonia Shaw was talking about that in the panel, that writing a good email is like almost imperative to every job you do. So I think that, you know, all of our editors at the review can do almost any job because of their work experience that they've gained here.
And absolutely. I mean, just having a journalistic foundation, knowing your facts, accepting all perspectives, and making sure that you're really kind of thinking about the world in a 360-degree way, I think is fundamental for anything that you pursue. So Nikki Keating and Delaney Fox, I wish you the best, and congratulations on 150 years. They are the two co-editors in chief of the Oberlin Review. Thanks for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
Time now for another quick break. On the other side, we hear from Cleveland poet George Bilguer on the poetry of aging. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks for spending the hour with us. From Maya Angelou to Dylan Thomas, Mary Oliver to Alfred Lord Tennyson, poets have always written about the experience of aging. It's a topic that's ripe for reflection, full of metaphor and meditation. Cleveland poet George Bilguer's new collection of poems, Cheap Motels of My Youth, is full of those reflections. He looks back at how his parents raised him, how his own life might or might not echo those of those parents, how time seems to go by quicker and quicker as one grows older, and what it's like to be the father of two young boys. IdeaStream coordinating producer Drew Mazzia sat down with George Bilguer to mark National Poetry Month, which is April, and talk about his new work.
George Bilguer, welcome to The Sound of Ideas.
Drew, thank you so much for having me on.
Pleasure to have you in the studio. Let's start by having you read your poem, Where Will You Go When You Die? Because I think it's very touching and it's also pretty funny.
Yeah, it's an important thing to think about, you know. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be surprised. Here's the poem, Where Will You Go When You Die? Lord, with all due respect, would it be okay if I just stayed here in Cleveland, in my own backyard, perhaps in the form of ashes strewn in the flower garden? I'll watch my kids playing in the sprinkler or chasing each other with their lightsabers through summer. I will observe my wife grilling chicken on the barbecue, not with the same skill, clearly, as her late husband, although she does seem to be improving, as I can see from my vantage point over here next to the hydrangeas, which I so often failed to fertilize or weed or even water back when I was alive. Make yourself useful, she used to say, and here I am doing exactly that.
That's great. It's very touching, it's very sweet, and it's funny. In this collection, you write about mortality, raising your kids, colonoscopies, and even realizing that you look like your grandfather. Did you have the intention of publishing a collection that dealt so much with, you know, looking back and nostalgia and growing older?
Yeah, I did. And I think as I am growing older, the great theme of poetry is aging. And, you know, the former poet laureate Billy Collins commented once that if you are majoring in English, you're majoring in death. because so many poems, stories, films, novels deal with that inevitable fact. And yeah, I'm thinking about it more and more as I get older, and especially since I've had kids, because nothing reminds you of how swiftly time passes than watching those kids rushing through life.
As you're starting to see a theme in the work that you're writing and kind of tackling these topics, what's the work process look like? Are you just focusing on writing about the idea of growing older or these nostalgic things, talking about your parents, talking about your kids, or when other ideas and concepts come up, do you kind of allow that to become a poem in its own right?
I almost never start with an idea. Hmm. I mean, I start with an image, something I've seen, something that stays with me. I think maybe like a lot of poets, I carry, well, probably now people, you know, use the Notes app on their phone, but I carry a little notebook in my pocket. And when I see something that strikes me, startling image or something, I make a little note of it. And then when I sit down at my writing desk in the morning, I've got a few little things that might turn into a poem. But for this particular collection, I gathered together a lot of poems that somehow I thought spoke to each other about those themes of aging and having kids and, you know, what my father's life was like having me and what my life is like having kids of my own. You know, situating myself in the middle of those two realities has been, you know, I'm sort of living my life backwards. I'm 72 and I'm like the world's oldest, fairly new dad. So one of the things that having kids late in life has given me is something to write about.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you talked about your process a little bit, because I did want to ask you about that, because I love getting a peek behind the curtain of what an artist does. Yeah. You talked about writing from in a notebook in your pocket that you carry around. Can you talk a little bit about the discipline of you wake up every morning, you work on a poem, you let the inspiration strike you, you choose to do this or that. What does that kind of that work ethic look like on a day-to-day basis for you?
Well, I'll tell you, I keep my mornings as clear as possible. I teach at John Carroll University. I'm a professor of English there. And I try as much as possible to keep my classes in the afternoon. I get up in the morning, and for years, for at least 25 years, I have written in a cafe. I'm a cafe writer. The idea of sitting down at a table in your private office with the door closed and no possibility of interruption, I can't stand that. I need to know that I might not have to go through this arduous process because some friend will come up and want to shoot the breeze with me for a while. So I walk, I get up, you know, I take a shower, I get my writing notebook together, and I stroll down to a favorite cafe in Cleveland Heights, and I order my coffee, and I sit down, and I look at those little note prompts and wait for something to happen, wait for a phrase. I'll jot a few things down. But I do have a steadfast rule. I will not leave until I have written a poem. Hmm. Now, it may not be any good. I mean, that's certainly not guaranteed. But if I feel blocked, nothing's happening, I'll look across the room and say, look, there's someone dropped their napkin on the floor. Let's write that down. Someone dropped a napkin on the floor. Where can I go with that? And maybe that will turn into some meditation on man's fall from grace. Who knows? Or just a poem that I throw away.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I want to leave with something done.
Mm-hmm. I hear that a lot from especially songwriters, is no matter what, no matter how good or bad the song might be, as long as you have something every single day.
Yeah, and then at the end of the week, I sit down at the computer at home, and I have at least five drafts of poems. Maybe at the cafe, a couple of things have happened. Mm-hmm. But I will type all those up. I write by hand in an artist's notebook, and I look through, I type them all up, and I think, you know what? One of those poems has a little spark of life in it and might be worth keeping. But usually, you know, if I get one out of four, that's great. And then I start working on it and kind of fiddling around with it over a period of weeks. Mm-hmm. And maybe after a couple of months, I will say, you know what, that's ready to go out to a journal. And I'll send it out to be probably to be rejected, but hopefully someone will take it.
Mm-hmm. You touched on this a little bit earlier as well. I'm curious about what being a father has done to not only what you write about in your poetry, but your overall workflow. Was it a disruption having small children? Was it a disruption in the routine to get the work done? How has it kind of impacted you, not only in what's in the poem, but the craft of poetry?
It was a tremendous disruption at first because I never slept like most parents. You know, I was up all night. It was the first year, I have two kids, and the first year of each of their lives, what I did mostly was watch a lot of Netflix in the middle of the night, you know, and you're just trying to catch up. So there wasn't much writing that happened then. But then I started picking it up again. And, you know, in many ways, it's helpful to get away from it and gain a fresh perspective. And suddenly I had all this new material to write about. Yeah. And my kids have been a wellspring of inspiration for me. Years ago, when my friends, poet friends, started having kids and started writing poems about them, I saw a lot of diaper poems, poets writing, and I would write them kidding them. I'd say, oh my God, I never thought this would happen to you. You're writing the beautiful diaper poem. And now I'm writing the beautiful diaper poem. So I've come, you know, full circle.
we're talking during National Poetry Month when we see a big push to celebrate poets and expose more people to poetry. What are some of your techniques that you use when getting poetry in front of the masses and not just your students at John Carroll University?
How to get poetry? You mean my poetry or poetry in general?
In general. Yeah. What's the entry point that you tend to use?
I certainly make use of social media. Facebook and Instagram. I have a website of my own, georgebilguer.com. But the particular thing I do that might be a bit unusual for most poets is I have my own radio show on John Carroll WJCU. It's a show called Wordplay. It's on every Friday. And I have a co-host named John Donahue. And he and I, there's a lot of banter. There's a lot of fun with the show. Plain Dealer did a story on it once, calling it the car talk of poetry. Hmm. And it also airs at 7:30 in the morning on Saturdays. So I don't know what our audience is, but we've been doing this for 15 years. Oh. And we get a lot of feedback and response. So I love the idea. The poems we read are by poets, many of whom I know, but poets whose work I like, admire. And we call the poems radio ready. That is a poem that if you're driving down the highway on your way home from work, you're not going to turn the station. You're thinking, I like this poem immediately. I get it. It's accessible. So that's the best thing I can do to get poetry out there is to put it on the radio. And radio, I think, is the ideal medium for poetry. Watching someone read a poem at a podium on TV is deadly dull. But in your car, listening to someone read a poem, there's a wonderful intimacy about that that I've always loved.
I mean, we talk about that here on National Public Radio, the driveway moment, and it seems like the poem could be that perfect opportunity for the driveway moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Hmm. And poetry, to me, it's the art of creating imagery, the art of painting with words. Mm-hmm. So a good poem makes you see stuff in your mind's eye. And that's why I find watching a poet read on TV or on YouTube, I never look at the image. I'd much prefer to just hear it and see what happens in my own mind's eye.
Mm-hmm. We talked about your website, and you're putting up a poem every day for National Poetry Month. On today's webpage, we're recording this before it airs, you have the poem The Forge. And if I could I ask you to read The Forge for us?
Yes. My father was... He struggled terribly with alcoholism, and it finally killed him. And as I've said before at poetry readings to parents, if you want your kids to become poets, just become an alcoholic, because that drives you to it. So this is a poem for my father called The Forge. I remember watching my father stop halfway up the driveway because my tricycle was blocking the way to the garage, and how he solved the problem by picking up the tricycle by the handlebars and smashing it through the windshield of our brand new family station wagon, his face red with scotch, his black tie and jacket flapping with effort, the tricycle making its way a little farther with each blow into the roomy interior of the latest model. As the safety glass relented, the tricycle and the windshield, both praiseworthy for their toughness, the struggle between them somehow making perfect sense in midday on our quiet suburban street. The windshield, the anvil. The trike, the hammer. The marriage, the forge. And failure, glowing in the heat, beaten and tempered, slowly taking shape.
On the webpage for that poem, you have a blurb that says, "My father's drinking has been the turbulent wellspring for 100 poems." Mm-hmm. I wonder how much does your poetry help you either wrestle with perhaps becoming your parents on one hand or ensuring that you don't become them on the other hand?
Wow, that is a great question. Both. Mm-hmm. It keeps me mindful, ever mindful, of what happened to my father and what it did not only to his life, but to his wife's life, to his children's life. And it's a constant warning. Mm-hmm. You have your greatest responsibility is to your children, and you've got to protect them from calamities like that. And whatever the demons were that haunted my father or any person who's struggling with addiction issues, I don't think I'll ever know them, but I have spent my career as a poet in part exploring them, trying to understand them, and maybe it leads to a different insight and awareness on my own part of my responsibility to my kids.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the last poem in your new collection, Cheap Motels of My Youth. It's titled Salad, and I would love to have you read one more before we close, and then we'll just talk about that poem for a second at the end here.
Here's the poem, Salad. It is a summer evening in 1948. My mother and father are in the backyard of the little duplex they rented. Summer evening in St. Louis. I have yet to exist, but nonetheless, I know that two hamburgers are on the grill and the beer is cold in the humid dusk. A dog barks next door. My father turns the burgers. My mother goes in to set the table for two and make a salad. There's more beer in the fridge. They don't even have a TV. Nobody does. In the kitchen that does not include me, the burgers are great, and my father says something that makes my mother laugh so hard that I can hear her in my backyard tonight in Cleveland, where, thanks to them, I exist at the grill, a beer in my hand, a dog barking, my wife in the kitchen making a salad.
I really do love that poem because there's this circular kind of meta narrative of you watching yourself, watching your parents in a very metaphysical way that I thought was really, really interesting. Can you just talk about what it was like to write something like that? And again, wrestling with this time in your life where you are your parents, but your own person and you're watching your kids grow up.
Yeah.
And yeah, what that relationship is
well,
like.
Well, first of all, I do remember as a kid standing out at the grill with my dad, who was a great griller and loved to come home on a summer evening and grill, and something I have inherited, and I have the same love for it. It's an odd thing, you know. It's you're standing out there in the driveway kind of poking at chicken, sipping a sipping a beer, thinking this really looks I never expected this to happen to me in my younger, wilder days, that I'd be, you know, mowing the lawn on Saturday morning, then grilling at the grill. I do not, I want you to know, have a world's greatest dad grilling apron yet, but it's only a matter of time.
Yet.
But that poem is an example of a kind of, well, maybe trick isn't the right word, but it's something I like to do in poems. I'm really interested in bouncing around in time in poetry. Those sudden collisions of past and present, You can do them in a novel in 400 pages, or you can do them in a poem in 20 lines where you were in the past, boom, it's the present. Mm-hmm. And there is that frightening quality about time that, oh my God, a decade has passed. I hardly noticed. Yeah. Where did it go? And my kid's 11. What happened to the little creature I could hold in one hand? Mm-hmm. So that poem does that kind of ping-ponging back between past and present that I like to do.
The collection is Cheap Motels of My Youth, poems by George Bilger. George, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Drew, this has been a blast. Thanks a million.
That's our Drew Mazzius in conversation with poet George Bilger, whose new collection of poetry is available at Max Back's Books on Coventry Road. Now, tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, we're going to talk about judicial safety. With increasingly hostile attacks on judges over political disagreements, we'll discuss this topic of judicial safety with federal judges in Ohio. And coming up next Thursday, join us for the next stop on the Sound of Ideas community tour. It's a forum that's going to be about wealth, power, and Northeast Ohio. We'll ask if it's possible to obtain power without first having wealth, who has the power here in our region, and how they obtained it. That's going to be happening live at the Cleveland History Center at 6 p.m. We'll be discussing wealth and power. The event is free and open to the public. You can find more information at ideastream.org/community tour. I'll be there. Mike McIntyre will be there. We hope to see you. If you miss any portion of today's program, find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening. I'll speak with you again tomorrow.
The Sound of Ideas is produced by Rachel Rood, Lee Barr, Drew Mazzius, and Jay Shaw. Chris Dudley and Samson Auble provide technical assistance. Jay Nungesser is at the controls of the Ohio Channel broadcast, and our host is Jenny Hamill. Thanks for tuning in.